But we really soon deviated from the syllabus, the tentative syllabus that I proposed at the beginning of the semester.
Do we have a picture?
Yeah. Let me make this a little bit larger. So that was the original proposed plan. So fingerprinting, that would also be part of watermarking. So 2 hours on watermarking, but then only 1 hour on steganography and a little a bit of other topics in between, like the signal processing in the encrypted domain, biometric cues and so on. And then, I mean, when we started to talk about stuff, there was a remark like, can we do a little bit more on steganography or so? And then it's like, yeah, sure, we can. It also makes sense from a, I think, from a technical perspective. So the way I changed this now effectively is again, let's make this a little bit larger. So I think I did this from the top of my head. I hope it's correct, but I think it is. We did 3 hours on watermarking, particularly discussing these robustness, payload, security, imperceptibility things, and then looked at the papers to re-identify things. So it was like 3.5 hours on watermarking, and then we had another half hour or meeting, like introduction to steg analysis, steganography, and then a little bit like introduction here. And last time I was referring to this series of papers from the group at Binghamton at around 2010-11 or so, showing like, okay, can we do a more complex embedding? Oh, then we need a more complex detector, and going back and forth. And I'm just going to wrap this up today and would then move to image forensics to have the three large topics covered from this information hiding domain. And would say, okay, we can do, for example, the last hour, like just make like a fly through or so. What were the things that we actually omitted when, like, we did not talk about biometric cues, we did not talk about the signal processing in the encrypted domain. So maybe we can make just a tutorial like or overview like thing of other topics. Yeah. As you will see, they are a little bit different. Like the type of tasks are a little bit different from these three larger ones. So the larger ones complement each other nicely. So they are relatively compact in terms of content, tools, and so on. The other topics are a little bit further out. So I thought these are better things to sacrifice. But we can also negotiate that if you would like to pick something up for another hour or so, just let me know. Yeah, we can. It's not a big deal. Otherwise, I would spend really most or almost all of the time remaining in this semester on image forensics. That's also my special field, so we can make this at an arbitrary level of detail, actually. But I can also, I mean, I can also hold on to myself, and we can do something else, of course, no? Yeah, I don't care, no? It's, but I think that would be a, from my perspective, reasonable proposal for the second half of the term, yeah? Okay, I put this list on Studon. Oops. Okay. Anyways, no, that's my campus, sorry. Ah, here. Yeah, so the name of the PDF changed to MMSEC syllabus updated. So that is the new version, yeah? Good. Okay, let me know. Now, okay, in order to wrap up things, so I put in the wrap up things on steganography. I put a nice set of slides here in the literature section by Jessica Friedrich, also from 2011. So it integrates nicely with the papers that are there. Hold on. Here. So these slides have a very, very nice tutorial-like beginning, just summarizing a couple of fundamental results. And then in the second half, essentially restate what is written in the papers also. So it's a little bit of duplication, but don't worry. No? So let's look at the first half really quickly, just to get an impression of what this all is about. So, okay, we already know what steganography is. Is it a relevant problem? Okay. Apparently, a number of publications grew on this, so that's a common way of justifying interesting thing. Also, the number of software stego applications consistently grew. Okay, and in terms of where these software pieces embed data, images sort of are the market leader. And yeah, that's essentially also the reason why we are looking at images here. Okay, so, right, and then there are this a couple of fundamental questions that I would like to quickly browse through. So, how to hide information securely? What does it mean, securely? How much can I embed undetectably? How should I embed? Okay, so this how should I embed and so on, that leads already then to the current research. But what might be interesting in this set of slides are these first three questions. Okay. What are the most relevant problems? What are the main achievements? Okay. So, like from a theoretical perspective, all the possibilities to embed things depend on how well we know our source. So the cover media. If we have exact knowledge about the source, then it's typically an artificial source. And so IID heist, means like random, like independently drawn sequences, identically distributed, independently drawn sequences. Markov chains are a fancy term of just saying I have some, probability distribution that if I know one neighbor, what the pixel next to it looks like. Yeah. So here in this artificial domain, everything is easy. Yeah. So we know we can embed, like there's always a way to embed something in such a channel, such that the distribution of the channel does not change. So if the analyst performs a statistical analysis on the transmitted data, then from a statistical perspective, the Stego image, for example, or the Stego data and the cover data are indistinguishable. Okay. The other thing, the other important thing are the empirical sources. So let's just say real world images in our case. Yeah. So here's the problem that there exists no exact model for what a real image looks like. Yeah. This depends on a lot of influencing factors, of course. And that sort of kills all the super nice theoretical results. Yeah. So we cannot exactly say how many bits per pixel we can embed without being unnoticed, because we don't have a model that describes what it means to be unnoticed. Also in terms of detection, it's not really clear. Like there are no real strong theoretical results what can be done here. Okay, sorry, here for the artificial sources, let me add, optimal detectors are likelihood ratio tests. So that these are statistical tests, yeah, to test for the presence of a Stego signal. Okay, so we know this picture already. We embed something, there's this super powerful warden, and we get the picture, the Stego message past the warden. And then here's something that I also mentioned in the definitions, like on day two of our steganography stuff. So we can look at the Kullback-Leibler divergence to measure or to quantify the security of a steganographic system. What is the Kullback-Leibler divergence? It essentially says, if I know one distribution, like how much do two distributions differ? This means if the Kullback-Leibler divergence equals zero, so if both distributions do not differ, then we cannot, then the cover and the Stego image are just indistinguishable and we achieve perfect security. Yeah? And this is only possible on theoretical, on these artificial data. No? Okay. And then there's another concept is this epsilon security that we say, okay, so maybe we cannot get this Kullback-Leibler divergence down to zero, but maybe we can say we bound it to some value epsilon, and then we're talking about epsilon security. All right, so right, so here's essentially what I said already. It's just, and we don't need to learn every letter from these slides or so. Yeah, let's just to get a better impression or so. So if we have full knowledge of the cover source, then we can build a perfectly secure Stego system. So that's an important theoretical result from 1997. Essentially, the idea is that we say, okay, if we have perfect knowledge of the source, then we can create a source and a code combo that has the statistical properties of that source. So that is what is meant here with this cover synthesis. Yeah. So we can then just create artificial images, for example, in this case, that exactly have the statistical properties that we are looking for, but we also have our signal already embedded. Yeah. But this is all theory, as I said. And also here, this first practical realization for JPEG images, we looked it up on Monday. It's a more like a, it has very strong assumptions. So it's not really practical, probably, this approach. But from a theoretical perspective, I think it's an important result. Okay. Now, the steganographic capacity is how many bits of information can we embed per cover element, in our case, per pixel. Yeah. Yeah, some more theoretical results. What I would like, to show is here the square root law of secure payload. I think this is an important point to be aware of. So a secure payload is something like you embed little enough such that your content goes unnoticed in the stream of the data, yeah? And I think intuitively it's clear if you only embed in every 100th pixel something, then it's less visible or less detectable than if you embed something in every pixel or so. And this square root law, what does it assume? So it says, so the cover source is a first order Markov chain with transition probability matrix A, probability of having xn equals j given xn plus 1 equals I. So that is, so we say this Markov chain model, it essentially models neighborhood relationships. Yeah. So let's say we have a probability model for modeling neighborhood relationship. The embedding is a probabilistic mapping applied to each pixel independently. And the steganographic system is not perfect. So the Kullback-Leibler divergence is larger than zero. good. And then the square root law theorem establishes a relationship between a secure secure payload and the length of the message that is transmitted. So n is the message that is transmitted. So let's say that the length of that message goes towards infinity. And m is the actual payload. So a conservative payload means that this ratio, the payload over the square root of the message length, goes towards zero. And an unsafe payload means if it goes towards infinity. Okay, in the special case is, of course, if it's exactly constant. Okay. and this has an important interpretation, actually. Okay, let's not deal with the mathematical derivation because we did not go that deep into detail. But let's have a look at the interpretation of that law. Yeah. So it means if we have a 10 times bigger image, then we can only, because we have this square root relationship, we can only hold a 3 times bigger payload at the same level of statistical detectability. Yeah? Because the attacker has just more examples also to look at. So the attacker also has improving statistics. So that is probably a way to think about it. Okay, so or differently expressed, so same statement, just the other way around. It is easier to detect the same relative payload in larger images. Okay, and that means that when you're performing benchmarks or something, then you have to make sure that payload over square root of message length, sorry, cover length, the root rate is fixed. Okay, so I think these were a couple of nice notes or so, summarizing a couple of things. Okay. Actually, there are two or three more nice slides, but then it goes very much towards the work that we already discussed last time. So, good. So how shall we embed in practice? So one possibility is to address a specific attack. That's typically not a good idea because maybe there will be another attack. Then a second way is to follow a specific model, like statistical model, try to stay within that model. In that case, we would need to use a sufficiently complex model, or we just try to mimic natural processing. This is a very complicated task since we're leaving this analytical space. So we could think of some training base, like a generative system, for example, if you think about this, trying to model natural images, for example, but it would be very complicated to I think it's related to the problem of having data sets that we use for classification generalize over the specific data set collection. So it's the same instance of problem just here for generative processes. When making an attempt to create a cover or a Stego cover that is undistinguishable from a natural image. Okay, or use as an objective the goal of minimizing the embedding distortion. And this is actually what is done in the papers that we looked at, or what is the typical approach. Okay, and I think that is then where, right, where she's starting to talk about her own work. So, you can look at it. I mean, of course, maybe it makes even sense to look at it before reading the papers, unless you haven't done so already. Or you can look at it afterwards and just check or make sure that you got the most important points from the papers, something like that. Yeah, whatever you like. Okay. I think that is all that I wanted to say about steganography, steg analysis. But if you have questions or if you like to have me highlight a specific aspect or something, just let me know either now or later. Yeah. Any questions, remarks? Okay. Then let me say something. When you think of watermarking, and when you think of steganography, it may be a good exercise actually to think about, okay, which parts are similar and which are different here, yeah? Because it's actually, so, So what is similar or similar things? Let's collect a couple of things. Differences, similarities. Of course, only based on what we have seen in this class. Just say something. What is say it, yeah. Okay. Okay, we have like the same carrier or so. So once we call the carrier cover for the steganography, once we call it just, I don't know, image or so. Yeah, carrier maybe indeed, no? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this can be a JPEG image, for example, no? JPEG image. So that means whatever we learn or know about JPEG images, we can certainly recycle it, no? That's probably one thing. So and indeed, yeah, that's actually true. I mean, we had in the for the watermarking, so example, so a derived example of this argument, yeah? For the watermarking, we said we can have a watermark in spatial domain, so essentially between neighbored pixels or in DCT domain, yeah? In the frequencies, and we can actually do the very same with a steganographic protocol, yeah. It literally translates, and it's also, I think, at the beginning of the first or second steganography paper, they say like, yeah, you know. Ah, no, actually it's in this report, like how we, breaking Hugo, the process discovery. And it's like, yeah, isn't it known that it is a bad strategy to operate in spatial domain? Shouldn't we better operate in DCT domain to perform our analysis? But for some reason we found, okay, so spatial domain is cool anyway, something like this, yeah? So the same types of arguments are pulled here, right? Another item. Yes?
the Stego systems need to be non-detectable. And mm-hmm. water marking can profit from it, but doesn't need it.
Yeah. Detectability. So this is like a crucial, like a hard security requirement for Stego systems. And I would not say that it doesn't play any role for watermarking, but it's more like a soft, it's a softer criterion. Yeah. Do watermarks have any hard criteria?
I would say they share the similarity of robustness and payload. Mm-hmm. So the term payload basically is the same for all of them, and mm-hmm. it's the same problem, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So increasing the payload
properties. Yeah.
Also robustness in terms of image filtering, JPEG compression is also a problem for both.
Let me just say brings challenges. I mean, of course we like to increase the payload, but then like we have to work for this. For robustness, I think I would contradict a little bit. I think robustness is exactly the analog for this. Yeah. For a watermark, it's a hard requirement. Like we cannot do without it. It's a hard requirement for watermarks. For non-fragile watermarks. Let's not make it too complicated. So, normal watermarks. It's of course something that we also want for steganographic systems, but it's not the topmost priority. Yeah. So let me write a soft requirement for Stego systems. Yeah. Here's the interesting thing. So if we talk about detectability, no? In a watermarking context, so for steganography, detectability is absolute. Yeah, like there's no, like there may no be no clue whatsoever. Yeah. That's maybe. Okay, if we think about watermarking system, detectability splits a little bit in two categories. So one is, can we see it with the eye? Then it's disturbing. Yeah, it's annoying. Yeah, and the other thing is that detectability, more in a statistical sense or maybe a steganographic sense, that we say, can we identify the pixels where the watermarking information is contained? Because if that is possible, then the watermark can also be exposed to some attacks. And that's, I mean, that's not such an immediate problem, probably like in the steganographic case, but it's also a problem. Yeah. So let me just write down detectability has for watermarks two aspects. Visual perceptibility and statistical it's not good if I detectability repeat this statistical let's keep detectability here, but it's certainly not a perfect formulation. So
maybe if you replace visual perceptibility with fidelity.
Yeah, we can put this. Yeah, that's okay. Fidelity. Okay. Okay, fidelity is something that falls more in the category nice to have. Yeah, I mean, good for the application always, no? But a statistical ability that goes in the security direction. Yeah, so if we can pinpoint where the watermark is, then it can be attacked also. Hmm? Okay. That's fine. I mean, these are some points already. But yeah. Yeah. If you think about the media, yeah, the watermark, a watermark has, there's another difference that is nice actually. Yeah. So the watermark does not control the source. I mean, someone says, okay, I'd like to watermark that image, and you have to say, okay, do it, yeah? Or I'll do it. But the Stego Alice can come up with an arbitrary natural source. Yeah. So all that is Alice is concerned about, so she may select a source that she likes best. It's totally up to her. The only thing is that this source has to look natural. Yeah. It may not be an artificial like distribution or something. Yeah. And that is the problem, because we know, okay, for artificial sources, we can create, well, we just saw in the slides, also, we can create perfect Stego systems and we're good, yeah? Okay. Good. Yeah, we can expand on this later, or if more things come to our mind, we can expand on this later. Good. Shall we talk about image forensics? Good. So, particularly, I would say blind image forensics. Although most of the time I like to omit blind, but. The task here is to make a statement or investigate image authenticity and origin without the help or support of an embedded, let's put in brackets, actively embedded security scheme. Blind means that we do not have knowledge, we do not have any knowledge about applied attacks provenance of the image or whatever, like we just don't know anything. You get an image and have to look at it, like forensically investigate that image. That is the task. So we immediately see a couple of differences here to the other two major fields. So all this source discussion, like, in which source do we have to embed and what do we do? So we're not controlling the source here at all. Also, for watermark verification, we always have the benefit that we can assume if there is a watermark in there, then we actively embedded it. So we have a lot of control here. These are all differences in the forensics case. Okay, we will see how these other keywords here translate or can be potentially adapted to the forensic setting. So first of all, what does authenticity mean? What does origin mean? Origin means from which device or which camera model, if we are talking about pictures, is the image taken. As always, we can seamlessly extend this to video. We can also think about audio forensics and so on. But let's talk about images. Authenticity is a little bit problematic to define in a rigorous way, but let's just say has the image been changed such that has the image been changed? And this, I mean, what means changed? Yeah, does changed mean recompressed or so? Yeah. So the meaning behind this is, such that the such that the image semantics are different after the change. So that is what we mean, yeah? And that is what we consider a manipulation. So this is, that would be a manipulation. A manipulation or a forgery . The problem is with semantics, we cannot, there's no way to deal with that in a technical way. Yeah. So technically, we are looking at a certain class of changes and say, okay, if these changes happened, then we are certainly interested to know that. And then we have to see how we proceed from that. Yeah. So in reality, there is no technical way to check for semantic changes. Therefore, we look for a class of irregularities that should not occur in harmless modifications. So that is what we can do. And then we see how we can deal with that. What we can add to the origin task, or you can make a third point, is, but maybe it's worth to write this down. You can just write it below origin and authenticity, is this task of image provenance. It's essentially a variant of the origin task. So which harmless modifications have been done? Okay. So it could be like you capture an image with a camera, you upload it to Facebook, someone else downloads it, recompresses it, re-uploads it. Things like that, yeah.
So external stuff like natural like, I mean, light sources also are not part of the origin. So the origin is focused on camera model or not on the light model of the scene or so. It's just different.
That would be... Yeah, so the origin, if when we talk about origin, we typically mean, does that image come from a Sony camera? That would be a typical question, no? Sorry?
Where the image is stored after clicking, basically, right?
Sorry, can you say this again?
Origin means like where the image is being stored after being clicked.
Yeah, or through which, not necessarily where they were stored, but through which imaging pipeline did this thing go, the photons or so? So it's really about the device, yeah? and this can be either a specific device, no? Like was it this camera or was it that camera? Or it can be a model, like a Sony camera, for example. Yeah. So these are the typical questions. So the lighting can come into play here when we are trying to put arguments on authenticity. I know. You could say an image has, for example, associated EXIF data. And there, the camera stored like the GPS coordinates at the time of the acquisition. And of course, also the time and date and so on. And then you can say, okay, so if this was in Central Europe, in winter at 4 p.m. in the evening, then it should be already, like, it shouldn't be so bright anymore, things like that, yeah? So these types of arguments are also pursued by a couple of people. Interestingly, yeah, maybe they would also fit best under this authenticity thing, because then if image content and EXIF text don't really fit together, then one would say, okay, like either one or the other thing has probably been modified, no? Good point, yeah. So you know that depending on where you are on Earth and what time of day it is and what season and so on, the sun has the color spectrum of the incident sunlight is a little bit different. It's just like super hard to actually measure it. So it's, yeah, but that's a different topic. So assuming you could measure it, you could also use this for fingerprinting your stuff, no? Okay. Let me show you, like most of my work are, I think all of my work actually is on authenticity, but we will talk about methods from both directions. Let me just show you a couple of cues that can be used. So in general, in principle, what is the idea or the overall idea of these image forensics methods? We have the picture. So it's an animation. Sorry for this. Okay. So, don't sleep. Okay. So, sorry, this is a German point here. It's an older slide. Anyways, so here is a super simplification of the imaging pipeline to illustrate different steps that all leave artifacts in the final image that can be used for authenticating the image content. Yeah. So first of all, by the way, do you know this picture? It's already an old picture. It's from 2009, maybe. Iran was testing a couple of rockets, and one of the rockets did not launch. So they painted, or they essentially copied the dust cloud and so on from the neighboring rockets over that one that didn't launch, and published that picture. But also this picture showed up, and also if you look closely, you also see that it's a copy. So it's a nice example of a copy move forgery. Anyways, so you have a scene in the world, yeah? So you have certain geometric constraints. If it's a physically plausible picture, you have certain lighting constraints or so on the objects in the scene. Like, for example, if you have a couple of people outside on a flat square walking under direct sunlight, then all the shadows that are cast should be drawn in the same direction. Things like this, yeah? I mean, just to illustrate the type of consistency check that can be applied, yeah? Okay, so that is the world. And then when we acquire the picture, first of all, light comes through the lens. There are lens artifacts, most notably probably chromatic aberration, so a slight color seam at the boundaries of objects. In principle, this is an unavoidable artifact from a physical perspective. But oftentimes cameras internally try to counter it with image processing on the digital signal processor. Anyway, so this is a physical artifact, a chromatic aberration, a color seam that can be expected to be consistent on all the objects in the scene. Okay, consistently distributed. We can discuss this later, how much this holds in practice. Okay, so the sensor has a specific like noise behavior, certainly. And then the digital signal processor is a vendor-specific item, model-specific item that performs the color demosaicing and has a specific camera response function, like a nonlinear function to make the colors more vivid, essentially. And then it also encodes a digital image. And there, like once we have the final image, we can also run specific checks for specific manipulation, types of manipulations, yeah? Like, for example, here, when there's something copied within the same image, we can look for self-similarities within that image or so, yeah? Or we can, so splicing means copying two images together from different sources, two or more, of course. And then there might be artifacts at the seams, for example, of that copy operation. Resampling means if we insert something into a picture and we have to change the size or have to rotate it a little bit, then this is internally implemented as a resampling operation or an interpolation operation that statistically looks a little bit different from the rest of the image. And there we will see, or I think probably Patrick already told you the second day, that these steganographic features, I mean, if you're looking for irregularities, that's essentially what steganography people are doing all day, right? So why not reuse this for image forensics? Yeah. Also double compression artifacts, that means JPEG compression, we had it a couple of times as a lossy compression step. Now, if we consider a scenario that we have a camera image, so the camera performs the first JPEG compression, then we take the image, copy it to our computer, open it, make a couple of adjustments, and save it again as a JPEG image. So that means the image has been stored twice in the JPEG format. So this means that we had twice lossy compression. And but in areas where we performed some editing, we removed the compression artifacts from the first compression. So there it looks as if the image was only compressed once. And this would be a typical inconsistency that would not be explicable with a normal like provenance of an image or so. No? Okay, so these are maybe the classical approaches that people have worked with in the past 12 years, maybe. And currently there's a big push towards using these steganographic features, using learning-based solutions and so on. We will also talk about that. Yeah? But these are the like classical model-based approaches. Okay. Good. So that was a very coarse introduction. Yeah. Now, maybe since not all of you attended image, well, most of you attended image processing classes. So we're probably fine. But are there like, do you have questions at this point? Let me switch on the light again. No questions? Then let's do really quickly. Let's really quickly have a look at copy move stuff. It's really simple. It's very straightforward. So here's a bigger. I need to. Sorry. Switch it out again. So here's a bigger version of the picture again, and here is the same picture again, this time highlighted with the copied areas. So this was copied over there. This was copied over there. And actually, I mean, this was also copied, but apparently we set our threshold too conservative, so we didn't find it. And yeah, sorry, these are German slides. I translate them and put them on Studon. So essentially, we have a self-similarity within the same picture. Yes, please.
I just wanted to know, is it possible to also check if a certificate is edited or, you know, it's Photoshop or something like this?
A certificate?
Yeah, like something in
Britain. Yes, you can do that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Here's maybe an important remark that should be made. That fits very well into the introduction. So we don't control the source of the images. That is what we said. Yeah. And that means we actually have there's no leverage at all. Yeah. So if you cannot influence the source in any respect, then we just have to live with what we get. Now we know from steganography, for example, yeah, there are very different types of sources. No? Steganography people said, okay, if I can make an artificial source, I can have my perfect embedding or so. Yeah, we have a similar property. I mean, not as nicely theoretically substantiated, but still, we have a similar property in image forensics, in the sense that if we have cooperative sources, we can apply a lot of checks and set up tighter bounds on what an original image is. If we have very adversarial conditions, there's oftentimes not much that we can do. And we will see specifically what that means very soon. Yeah. Okay, so coming back to the certificate question, yeah, there it really depends on what the input data looks like in a statistical sense. So yeah, first and foremost, in a statistical sense, yeah, is it if you're assuming that it has been manipulated, has it been manipulated, then stored as this and sent to some person, or has it been manipulated, printed out, scanned again, for example, yeah, and then sent to a person or so, yeah, because the second step, it's a very like aggressive laundering operation, no, that takes the statistical traces, like most of them out.
But if something is printed out or sorry, scanned, then that would be the source, right? A new scanned copy would be the source in that case.
Yes, yes, yes. So that, right, in that sense, you don't have an uninterrupted digital path from the manipulation to the analysis, yeah. And then things become complicated, like very complicated, no? So that would be one maybe extreme example or so, no? For not controlling the source. But when you think about an all digital pipeline, yeah? So you have a digital image, a digital like scan of the certificate or something, and then you edit it a little bit and send it away. So all digital. When you think about it, if it's a if this is, for example, a grayscale image or something, yeah, it could even be if it's not nicely done, that you see with the naked eye, like, oh, something has been cut out here and put in there or so, yeah. While if it's a properly binarized image, so you have a perfectly white background and all letters are perfectly black and so on, no? Then maybe you don't see it with the naked eye. And that's actually the same thing, or it's a similar thing when you start to statistically look at an image, yeah? So there are just some settings that you can create, yeah? In which it is almost impossible to notice a manipulation. And there are others in which it can be fairly well done. Yeah? It really depends on the situation.
Does manipulation add a layer to the original image, or
it can be a new layer? Yeah, that would work. Yeah, could be. Yeah? I mean, that is all out of control of the analyst. Yeah. So what the analyst knows is what the mathematical boundary conditions or statistical boundary conditions of his tools are. And that helps to interpret the output. No? For example, for these copy move forgeries, we know it must be a self-similarity within the image, no? But what if we consider, for example, a picture that for some reason just has naturally like strong self-similarities, yeah? Could be, like we're considering some like a controlled picture of a very regular grid-like structure or so, no? And we will have a lot of self-similarities if we set our thresholds loosely, no? Then a copy move detector will say like, oh, that looks like this, and it looks like this, and it looks like this. But then when you see the output of the detector, and you know, oh, my method is looking for self-similarities, then you can also say, okay, this was an expected failure. So I don't further pursue this. Yeah. And it could be a similar situation the other way around. Yeah. If you are looking at a document and you are running another forensic detector, say, and it creates a couple of false positives, for example, that you say, okay, actually in this situation, I'm not surprised. It's probably not very reliable here. Yeah. Or the other way around, if it doesn't detect anything, yeah, could also be a situation that afterwards you think like, yeah, okay, actually it also was not a good method for my current situation. Yeah. So it can happen in every direction. Yeah. So in that sense, I really like to put, or my feeling is that sometimes in the community, maybe it gets a little bit like the forensics part of image forensics gets a little bit forgotten or so, no? But to me, forensics is also, or is just of secondary importance, yeah? But to me, forensics really means also, if necessary, to look at things on your own. Like you don't need to necessarily be fully automatic on everything, no? Because if you're really, sometimes you have that situation that you're really interested in that one specific image and you like to know what was going on there. And then you can also take the time and analyze it thoroughly.
Is it more about context with forensics? Because it does depend on the single picture or single picture what was made with.
Yeah.
Instagram photography, it can be any message. It doesn't matter.
Yes. Yes.
It's
right. That's an interesting point. So I think both things exist. So one thing is to say, okay, I have applications where I just like to have some automated screening of things without looking at image content. For example, you could say, I am a news agency and I'm working together with a number of journalists, a finite number of journalists whom I all know personally to some degree. Yeah. And I regularly buy pictures from them. And all I would like to make sure is that the pictures that are incoming from them are from their respective camera. Yeah. But these are normal off the shelf cameras. So nothing fancy built in or so. Yeah. And then you would run a standard test on these images and say like, yeah, okay, that's again from him or so. No? There are other situations where you really, would like to look at the image content. So one guy who is maybe the most famous person looking at content is Hanif Arendt. Let me show his work to you really quickly. Do we have time left? Yes, we have enough time left. So that's him. He's really good. He's somewhere between computer vision and computer graphics from his background. And he was, together with Jessica Friedrich, maybe the first guy in the image forensics field. But he, like, Jessica Friedrich does more statistical things. And he is actually more, he comes, yeah, more from this computer vision, computer graphics direction. So here's an, and there are some interesting case studies that he did. Let me try to find something nice that I can show ad hoc. And then I think it becomes immediately clear. Ah, yeah, okay. Here's a nice example. It's really nice. but there are more examples on the web page, so don't feel constrained to this. So here's a thing. It's not really super important for us, but it's important to some citizens of the United States. So this person, Zapruder, he filmed the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And I mean, you see the video quality is, naja. and it's analog, it's not a digital video. And there are conspiracy theories that this video has been edited because the back of the head here is so black, blackish, that this video has been edited to conceal that there was a second shooter there. So not just Lee Harvey Oswald, whom they caught afterwards, or, well, is that proven? I don't know. Whatever. Doesn't matter, yeah? but this is, I guess it's kind of, at least that's the official version. So, yeah. But so some conspiracy theorists say, okay, so this has been edited there, and so probably there was a second shooter. And the type of work that Hani does from time to time, it's so nicely illustrated here. So then he starts to sort of reconstruct the scene. He starts with, okay, so there are enough pictures of Kennedy, so we can certainly reconstruct his head. From a number of views, and then what we need to do is to fit his, like, to fit his body in a proper pose. And then, yeah, so, okay, so actually we know where it happened, we know the elevation, we know the time of day, all these things, so we can compute the relative position between the sun, the vehicle, and of course the man in the vehicle. Yeah, so here's a slight inclination here. Okay, and then re-render the whole thing. And and he sort of concluded, okay, so it's just some self-shadowing or whatever. Like, that is what he obtains when he looks at this. when he does this re-rendering of that scene. So in that sense, he concludes he does not really see necessarily an inconsistency here or a cue for manipulation. Yeah. I think that's a nice, certainly rather extreme or so, but nice example for analog forensics, no? Like the classical non-digital type of work. You really look at the images and try to make sense of what you see. And unless you find a contradiction, you must assume that it's okay, no? So that also exists. And then also, like, mixtures exist, no? Of course. Yeah, we will come to this. I also did, I like Hani Farid's work really much. So I also looked at his methods always. And I also experimented with a method. That comes from him and one of his students originally. Yeah. Look at me. Great. Okay. So here it's about the direction of incident light. Yeah. It's probably not the best manipulation in the world when you look at this gray thing here, this gray gradient here. But nevertheless, we put two people from two different lighting situations together in one picture. And when you look just at the people, not at the this stuff here, these artifacts, it looks halfway is okay-ish at first glance, probably, yeah. And and then the way the direction of the incident light in the plane is computed is by looking at the intensity distribution around the contour of the object of interest, yeah? And you have to apply a lot of care by doing that. You have to avoid self, like segmenting self shadows and so on. So I think that is a typical nice example for a semi-automatic method. So you manually annotate what you need to provide to the algorithm. The algorithm helps you to compute some quantity of interest, like in this case, the intensity distribution. And then, yeah, you obtain a result. Yeah, we can talk about this in the next few weeks then. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Then thank you. See you next week. Oh, sorry.
I've seen that you've uploaded another paper on design.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about copy move stuff, but don't worry, we did not do it. So,
should we prepare for next week or?
No, it's too dense. Actually, what I wanted. Okay, hold on. What I wanted to. I think I closed Studon, unfortunately. Okay, so in case you look at Studon, you will see there's a copy move paper. It's rather dense. I could have opened it. Anyways, you can have a course look at it. It's a comparison of copy move descriptors that Vincent and me did. Vincent Christlein and me, so someone from Pattern Recognition Lab. You can have a look at it, but don't look at all the details. Yeah, it's too much stuff. Yeah, and I wanted to talk a little bit about these descriptors today, but we can do this next time. Okay.